Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avant Card. Get Ireland's first personalised pricing rates made for you.
Now, it's a regular feature of opinion polls that people are losing faith in the media. They think it's inaccurate or biased or out of touch. And alongside this, the professional media has to compete with the online versions, which are given away for free. So what's going to happen? Former Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger is the author of Breaking News, The Remaking of Journalism and Why It Matters Now. Alan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Obviously, the old model of funding newspapers, advertising plus cover price, that's not really working at the moment. Is there something, as far as you can see, that's going to replace that?
Well, I think it works for some newspapers, it doesn't work for others. But I think we have to face the possibility that in 5 to 10 years' time, the traditional relationship between advertising and news, which was a fate of history, a fate of accident in history, may come unstuck. And as a society, I think we have to decide, is it important that we have a factual basis for our discussions and our politics and our law, or not? If it is, then journalists are very good at providing that. And we may want to think of it more like a kind of public service, more like a police service or an ambulance service, as something that society needs.
Mm.
And we may have to think of different kinds of structures and corporations that will give us that.
Are you perhaps hinting that it needs to be subsidized? I think in some Nordic countries, they already subsidize local newspapers.
Well, I think that's right. But I think there are businesses that set themselves up as social enterprises where the public benefit of what they do is the main purpose. And if they can make a profit on top, that's better. And they can get some kind of tax breaks or better business rates or whatever it is in order to give them incentives and help them survive.
Mm. I suppose, though, central to that would be that debate about whether it's a public service or not, because there would need to be some degree of political will that newspapers provide a public service. Possibly not all politicians would agree with that. And increasingly large segments of the public don't agree with that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we look across the water and we see the President of the United States deliberately blurring the lines between fact and fiction, almost trying to create a situation where nobody has got any idea what is true. And I think we've recently seen that with Facebook, too. So I think the public do want to be able to know what's true and what's not. But I concluded as I was writing the book that really journalism is not sufficiently distinguishing itself from what's available on social media. And if journalism is going to attract the respect and trust that I think it needs, then it simply has to be better.
Yes. And I suppose getting people to recognize that it's better in the sense that... It seems almost as if a story in The Guardian or a tweet or a piece on Russia Today all have equal status and equal claim on the truth.
Well, rather frighteningly, the research shows that a lot of people think that. They're frank and they say, I think it's 50% of people are now saying, I can't tell what is good news and what is bad news. And it's quite frightening when you speak to teenagers and you say, where do you get your news from? They say, from Facebook. And you say, well, that's great. Where was it before Facebook? And they look at you blankly. So there's a huge job of media literacy, I think, which is necessary in schools as well.
But though that media literacy, I mean, because that can be a time-consuming business, and I think in your book there is one, you do give an example of you tracked a story, which I suppose is opposite given events today, about a so-called a scourge of rape taking place in Sweden, and you tracked the various claims made, and there was a lot of smoke and mirrors involved in that.
Yeah, it took 2 days. I mean, it was just a tweet, and it was such a horrific tweet. I sat there thinking, I wonder if that's true. And it took 2 days to find if it was true, and it turned out it wasn't true. But in a sense, more worryingly, what the perpetrators of hatred and falsity on the net often do is to say, look, mainstream media is ignoring this, retweet this. There's a conspiracy against us knowing these things. And it turned out that this particular story had been covered by mainstream media, but when you tried to click on the links, you hit a paywall. Now, I'm not against paywalls, but we're in danger of creating a information-rich environment for people who live behind a gated community, and everyone else has to make do with a poverty of information. And I think that is it partly explains the rise of the right wing in Sweden and the rise of populism throughout Europe.
Mm. Is there also a danger as well that because budgets are getting thinner and thinner and thinner in news in professional news organizations, that there's always a danger of some of them will start to rely on sources of information that perhaps aren't as reliable as they could be?
Well, I think that's happening already, and I don't blame reporters for that. I think they're under very great pressures, and you can see all the reasons why it's happening. You can understand why, if you're owned by shareholders, shareholders want their return, and so therefore managers cut costs because they can't make the sums add up in any way, which is why I think you have to have this different conversation and say, well, profit can no longer be the main driving force of news. It may not be. And if that's true, but if we still need news, then what kind of a conversation are we going to have about how that's going to be provided?
Mm. Who should be involved in that conversation?
Well, I think it's time that politicians obviously started having that, but I think it should begin with journalists. And in a sense, I think journalists are slow to realize the problem. So if you're a journalist over the age of 45 and you worked for somebody who owned a printing press or a broadcaster, that was a very nice life.
Mm.
And you can see the sort of contempt that people like that have for social media. But the fact is, social media is not going to go away, and some of it's very good as well as very bad. But I think journalists are going to have to confront the fact that life may change very rapidly in the next 10 years.
And the physical newspaper, do you think physical newspapers will survive?
Well, I think they will for a bit. We had a computer when I was at The Guardian that sort of asked that question every week, and we would go and say, is it time yet to switch off the presses? And the computer said no. But, the daily newspaper, I think, is going to be the threatened thing, and you can see that happening on a local basis already, that a lot of local papers are now going weekly, because the expense of printing and distributing, it's almost a Victorian system of production, is not going to make sense.
Yeah. And given that, I mean, the Guardian's pretty much got to the point now where it's not just a British title, really. It has a considerable presence on both sides of the Atlantic. The fact that The Guardian would seem to be doing reasonably well in the new environment, is that a one-off, do you think, given those special circumstances that The Guardian found itself in, or is this something that could be replicated by others?
Well, I think we were quick to recognise the digital storms that were raging around the industry and didn't sit there feeling nostalgic about the past. We tried to exploit it, and as you say, two-thirds of our readership is now abroad. And we've tried a funding model which really goes to the readers and says, a bit like NPR in America or Wikipedia, if you value this, will you voluntarily pay in order not just to access it yourself, but to keep it open for everybody, a bit like the BBC? And that seems to be working. The paper's on the verge of breaking even and has got a good fund of money behind it. So whether that would work for everybody, I don't know. I suspect the future is going to be about a mix of funding models.
Yeah. Tim, one of our listeners, wants to know, what does Alan think of the New York Times printing the anonymous story about Trump? Should papers and journalists not have to expose the person making such claims to give the story credibility? And if the person can't put their name to it, what are we, the reader, to believe?
Well, that's a good question, and the only reason I think you would believe them is because the New York Times is very fine newspaper, and I kind of trust it to, and this was an extraordinary thing that it did, and it was very risky, because if it backfires, then it will damage trust in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm prepared to trust the New York Times and say they must have had very good reasons, and they must know who that whistleblower is, and they feel this is a valuable contribution to our sense of how the White House runs, and that rather frightening picture.
I think the New York Times did actually run an explanation of what their fact-checking procedure was on that particular piece, and how they came to conclude that it, you know, they did come from who they say it came from, or who they think it came from.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult thing in journalism, because often people will tell you stuff that is truer and more useful, but they don't want to do it openly because they're going to get the sack, or it could, or they could go to prison. So sometimes as an editor, you have to say, well, I'm prepared to give this person anonymity because what they're saying is valuable. And in fact, that happens more or less every day on more or less every newspaper.
Yeah. Though, interesting enough, there is already a feeding frenzy both within the media and within the White House itself, trying to find out who this person was.
Yeah, that's always the first thing that happens, that somebody holds a leak inquiry. And I would imagine this person, whoever he or she is, went to great lengths to make sure that was going to be a difficult business to try and find out.
Alan, thanks very much for speaking with us today. That's Alan Rusbridger there, the author of Breaking News, The Remaking of Journalism and Why It Matters Now. We're going to take a break. After that, the Irish woman who didn't win the Nobel Prize.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avant Card. Get Ireland's first personalised pricing rates made for you.